So hello everyone, this is Mike Katz and welcome to another ConvoCast on the disposability of men call and group in which we've been discussing the subtopic of head injuries and football and particularly focused on CTE. Hope everyone's having the topic for tonight, we entitled it Football CTE Wars, Fallout from the Latest Medical Study. Last week, the Journal of American Medicine came out with, the largest and most involved study to date on CTE in football, and the findings were pretty startling and were covered by all the major press in the United States, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal and ESPN. And that was because the results, showed in brain studies that 110 of the 111 football player brains, NFL football player brains that were studied showed CTE, which is an insanely huge and high number. And the study also broke down into, if you only played college or if you only played high school, and, the high school and youth football numbers, like we talked about last week, we're just starting to get the data on that because people are just starting to donate your brain. So last week, study came out. It was very, very big news. And I think what we saw this week and what we're continuing to see is more fallout from that on kind of both sides of the equation. And there's so much going on in the news. Usually I just spend a few minutes in the beginning of the call, picking out two or three, relevant news stories. But looking through this week, it was like there were like 15. But I just wanted to put out a few quotes from some of those stories that I think, got me to think a lot and, might be good prompts for our discussion because, the question really is, okay, what do we do now? And it feels like one of those, at least I wanted to say turning, but at least like there's some momentum here. And I think, those who have been involved in this issue or perhaps other big social change issues will say, yeah, that's happened before and, nothing changes. But it certainly feels to me like there's some momentum because lots of football players are talking about it. Lots of parents are starting to talk about it. We're still not quite there, but one of the big things that we've tried to do is get the word out, and this really helps get the word out when you get such wide coverage. So here are a couple things that happened this week that I think could be, prompts for our discussion. So first of all, a lot of the activists, Concussion Legacy Foundation, some of the moms, like people who have been on this call, like Karen Kinzel and Cindy Faisal, were on TV and the radio talking about the impact of the study and getting the word out that, one of the big messages is that it's not one big hit, it's these repetitive hits over time, and really pushing the message that, youth tackle football below 14 is really the most positive change we can make. What was interesting is seeing football players, deal with this. On the one hand, there's an offensive lineman on the Ravens, 26-year-old John Urschel, who's really famous for being the, physics in football. He has a PhD in mathematics or physics. And he retired suddenly at 26 this week. Certainly not the first, but the latest in the spate of, very early retirements, in the wake of this type of news. And other famous players like Ben Roethlisberger, who's in his 30s, said, I'm thinking about CTE when I'm thinking about whether I want to play next year. They're also at the youth level, people saying, look, football is just not safe for children to play. It's bad for your brain. So you have those folks. I think probably the biggest news was there's a rookie safety, first-round draft pick with the New York Jets this week. He was sitting next to the commissioner of the NFL at a fan forum this week. He was asked about CTE, and he said, "I love football so much, to me it's a, quote, perfect place to die would be on a football field." And everyone there clapped, which was weird and uncomfortable. But in the wake of that, other players said, like Martellus Bennett, who was an Ivy League player who played with the Bills for many years, is now a commentator, said, "Football is great, but I ain't dying for this shit." And as Lisa pointed out, if you search on Twitter now for "football is not worth dying for," there's a very big conversation and, you know, lots of results. So it's interesting to see that make its way into the public discourse like that. The amazing thing is, even though we're seeing a lot of positive things, and I'll read a quote from one of the articles that came out in response to Jamal Adams. You know, one of the widows of one of the first players that died from CTE, came out and said, you know, "That kid just doesn't know what he's talking about." And one of the quotes in that article was, "Unfortunately, these players don't die on the playing field in a sudden death fashion. They die a horrible death later in life, leading to, in many cases, suicide. It's not a badge of honor for the gladiator who played 13 years in the NFL or 2 weeks. It's a real problem. The macho, tough guy mentality has got to change." And there are lots of those families sharing their stories about, you know, the awful, you know, things that happen to these men in their 30s and 40s and to their families who have to bear that. But on the other hand, you know, Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, whose job is to protect the shield at all costs, you know, sitting right next to Jamal Adams when he said a football field is the perfect place to die, said, "Yeah, no, he's just enthusiastic and he loves football. And by the way, football is safer than ever. You know, we're, and by the way, football players live longer than, you know, most regular people." So there's that messaging. And what I also saw was the kind of counter forces pushing back. Dunk published an op-ed piece that just completely tried to take apart the CTE study, said it was flawed. To me, reading that, being knowledgeable about this, you know, to the extent that we all are, it was just a hit piece. And, you know, I'm also seeing, you know, people who call themselves doctors or who are very tied to the football game out on Twitter saying, "Yeah, you know, we have to know more, we have to learn more, it's a nice study, but it's not enough." You know, in the meantime, people are dying. So it's... there are a lot of institutions and franchises and schools and people that have a very big interest in football's continued prosperity and that pushback, you know, that almost like cigarette industry denial type fake news pushback was another big thing that I saw, you know, in the news this week, which was kind of troubling. You know, so here we are with, you know, on the one hand, so much momentum towards getting the word out. On the other hand, there's that whole counter narrative that is being pushed more aggressively in response to that. And you still have people that don't really understand or appreciate, you know, the issue. And you have, you know, there was an article I saw, you know, where coaches are also repeating that message. Football is safer than ever. It's safer than ever. We have fancy helmets. We have tackling techniques. And we all know that, you know, none of those things prevent CTE. And they just don't. It's just kind of a marketing message. So to me, it was just a whirlwind of a week of news, all really on point with this issue that we've been talking about, right? How do we get the message out? How do we tell these stories? What resonates with people? Where is the science at? You know, so it was exciting to see it so front and center, but also a little disheartening to see all that pushback. And, you know, the question is, you know, where do we go from here? So... that's kind of my little news summary of this week in the football CTE wars. A lot of battles being fought, but what resonated with other folks on the call? That's what resonated with me. I wanted to open it up for a discussion of any of the things I brought up or things that I didn't bring up, and then hopefully we can circle back to, you know, what do we do about it. So the floor is open.
This is Lisa. I was really struck by the football is not worth dying for line. And I was wondering if we could create a series of memes that has some of the, you know, maybe it's in conjunction with the Faces of CTE organization.
Mm-hmm.
But even that guy who you had written about, Mike.
Donovan Hill?
Donovan Hill, thank you. Donovan Hill. Like if you had, you know, his photo and just football is not worth dying for and a couple little sentences about him, you could link back to the article. But we just had a whole series of those. Like I don't think the average person still, it's great that it's getting out in the public discourse, but I think the average person still thinks the way that football player did, that, okay, there's a small risk of sudden death on the field, and I'm willing to take that risk. And I just don't think they understand that CTE is what it is. So that's both what resonated with me and what, you know, a step we could do easily as something we could take action on.
I think that makes sense. Yeah, to me, football is not worth dying for, and the counter response to Jamal Adams saying that I think is definitely something that is sticky and catchy, and something we could execute. That's a great idea, Lisa. Any other thoughts on that or anything else, Carol?
My mute was off. Okay. I've been amazed at the coverage. I was amazed at the pushback, but I'm not surprised, I guess. And it's like all of a sudden everybody started to get it, that it's dangerous. But when you'd rather die on a football field than anywhere else, it's hard to... It's hard to fight that. And we know in football there's a lot to be said for the economic attraction of money. So you can pull your family out of the street.
Sure.
For, you know, the money that they pay you. If it means you're going to die at 45, so be it. Which is unfortunately what's happening today anyway. Middle-aged men are dying. So,
and most of them don't get to the NFL level.
That's right.
You know, there's a really strong attrition rate, which is good. So I had this hit about, I'm looking for vulnerability, and we have a culture that is really tuned in to child abuse. And I wonder about linking up football with child abuse.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point, and it's one that we've spoken about before, and I could let Lisa Hickey talk a little bit about that. That was, I think, one of her thoughts, you know, quite a long time ago. And I do know that some of the activists, like Kimberly Archie, who's mother of Paul Bright, who was a high school player who was found to have CTE after he passed away. She did a poll on Twitter that said, you know, is this child abuse? So that was an interesting, I think it's interesting. I think it's powerful. We've talked about it a little before. I don't know, Lisa, do you want to talk about that a little bit and couch it that way?
Sure. So, yeah, I had the same thing as you, is that so my thought was actually to do like a PSA type video or you know, like a 30-second PSA type of thing that just showed a father and son and they're kidding around and they obviously have this connection and the guy just looks straight at the camera and said, you know, if you hit a child in the head, people would call you on that and tell you you know, that was wrong and not to do it. And if you hit a child in the head over and over and over and over again, they would rightfully call it child abuse. And then you just cut to pictures of hits on a football field, and you're like, so why isn't football child abuse? Something like that. Like, it was never completely worked out to the T, but I think that it's such an important thing to call abuse when it really is abuse. And I don't see how you can think about it any other way other than abuse, is that you have children who are put in positions where they're getting hit in the head over and over and over, and they're not even old enough to make their own decisions about that. I think it's a very powerful way to go.
But the parents are often, am I online here? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you.
Oh. Yeah.
The parents are often as much to blame. Well, they are to blame. And they don't see it as child abuse because that's what they did. I mean, my son, who's fairly bright, said, I grew up hitting my head all the time, you know, playing games with the guys, and it didn't bother me at all. Of course, being his mother, I didn't laugh, but you don't, it's just what guys do, in a way.
Yeah.
And I know that's not true. I know that's not true, but he does not know it's not true.
I agree with you, Carol, but I also think that look at how the culture changed when it came to spanking kids. Spanking kids was seen as the norm a generation ago, and now it's starting to get into the culture as child abuse, and it's the same exact things that you hear where you say, oh, I was spanked as a kid and I grew up fine. And, you know,
No. I agree with you.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know that it's the parents, but I just think and this is why I didn't want to focus on just children necessarily. Like, I just think it's such a big problem. Like, I didn't want to just focus on youth sports as kind of this group goal. Because I think we have to get the message out there in as many different ways as possible. And some messages will resonate with some people, and some messages will resonate with someone else, and some messages will resonate with someone else. But all of a sudden, then you have everyone who has some message that resonates with them, and you have people saying, no, enough, this is wrong, we have to change society. So that's my view.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And the dog has something to say.
Affirmation from the dog. Yeah.
They're terriers. They always have something to say.
Yeah. So you know. I'm sorry. Was that Thaddeus?
No, it's Scott Jacobson.
Oh, hey Scott, how are you, sir?
Good
to speak with you. So. I know you joined a little late. We had talked about kind of the banner weekend news that has been kind of following that big medical study of CTE. We were talking about that a little bit. I thought there were a couple other points that I thought were kind of interesting. And one news item that I failed to mention. But, you know, what's interesting to me is that the doctor who's doing all this work, you know, Dr. McKee, she's been doing this for quite a long time, and you know, you can see her, you know, walking this super fine line, because on the one hand, she's coming out with a report that you know, her life's work is to discover how this disease is caused and to try and prevent it, and she's raising these alarms for precaution, and her work is being used in that way. But on the other hand, you know, she's, you know, part of kind of she's so connected to football, so she has to say things like, you know, I'm not willing to say football is doomed, you know, we're still looking at it, you know, we want to bring clarity to football players. But what was interesting to me is this very same week that all this stuff came out, The NFL announced that it was ending its partnership with the National Institute of Health. They had, a few years ago, pledged to, you know, when this stuff was coming into the news more completely, they had pledged to give $30 million to the study of concussions and head trauma, and they partnered with the NIH to do that. And this week they said, yeah, we're not going to do that anymore, we're out. And they're $18 million short of their pledge, and that money will not be going towards research for head injuries for sure. So I thought that was another pretty interesting data point in all that.
Who was the other partner, Mike?
The National Institute of Health, the NIH, and the NFL, the National Football League.
The NFL, okay.
The big boys.
Oh,
yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the messaging and back and forth, I really like the idea of doing something around football is not worth dying for. And I like the idea of doing something on sort of child abuse, although I know that's touchy because parents feel attacked. That's one of my concerns on that issue. But the other kind of interesting thing is with this story, just like with other stories, and, you know, we talk about this on our politics call that Lisa leads on Thursday. And we talked about it on the Stop Racism call, that Jackie Summers lead. And if this, this sort of deflection, diversion, discredit sort of thing that happens in the news cycle, you know, they call it, you know, fake news. You know, we see it in, you know, Trump Russia, and then all of a sudden someone says, oh, but that's not real. You know, you can't trust that. And it's amazing to kind of see this same sort of pattern repeated, right? The study comes out, and it's 110 out of 111 NFL players. And I think that number in itself is just so powerful. But, you know, people try and chisel away, and they say, oh, well, you know, the sample was self-selected, so you can't trust it, and it was a bad study, and discredit, shift. We have to study this more. We're not sure. We're doing things to make it safer. Don't worry. We have better tackling techniques. We have better helmets. We've changed rules. It's just interesting to see that repeated in so many different ways. To me, it's kind of fascinating. But I think in the end, no matter what you say, people understand 110 out of 111. Like, that's just a powerful thing. The numbers are powerful. And I think even putting out like a data sheet like that would be a powerful thing, like a meme that just has kind of the numbers. I think would be interesting.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of numbers, and that goes back to what I was saying before, is that some people are going to be more swayed by a more emotional message, whereas some people will be more swayed by numerical data. And I think it's going to be the combined effort of both which will really get people saying, oh, this cannot be ignored, and that's what we want.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot. Okay, any other thoughts on anything else that we're talking about? I have one more kind of interesting issue that I have loaded up, but I want to make sure everyone's got their say.
This is Scott. I had a reflection on, I think it was what Lisa was saying.
Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
About the different considerations Lisa had when she was reflecting on looking at parents. And I was reflecting on that reflection. And in that, one thing that comes to mind is, I'm pretty sure many of you are familiar with the trolley problem in moral philosophy, where there's two tracks, and on one track is five people that are tied down, and the trolley could hit and kill all of them, or you can pull this lever, and it changes tracks so it only kills one person. That's the first scenario. So what do you do? And the second scenario is you're on a bridge, and there's a hefty person there that they are just enough weight that if you were to physically push them onto the track, they would stop the trolley from killing five people. But in either case, one or five people is killed. It's just on the first scenario, you're pulling a lever and you're directly responsible. And then in the other case, you're pushing someone, and so in some way you could say you're one step removed. So it's the other person. The question is, do you pull the lever or do you push the person or not? And I feel as though when Lisa's talking about parents, you know, if you were to put them in a hypothetical scenario in their head, you know, if you say to them, look, if you were to take your kid and to punch them lightly in the head 100 times over the course of several months, and then that we know this causes trauma to the brain and therefore impacts life over the long term, would you do it? They probably wouldn't. But then if it's a few steps removed in the football field, or other sports for that matter, like soccer, there's a certain detachment there morally, and which is probably emotionally, because it's almost as if it's someone else doing it. It's the hefty person. I'm not the one pulling the lever. I mean, I think there might be some, you know, bug in the way that we're wired up to be able to think clearly about those things when, in terms of the outcome, they are the same. But in terms of the intent and steps away from that impact, that equivalent impact, it's different. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And the one thing I was thinking about as you were finishing speaking is, you know, in terms of being removed and saying, you know, I did everything I could, I think that's why so much of this stuff, like, well, you know, we're tackling better and we have better equipment. I think that's why that sort of resonance can resonate with certain parents or certain type of people. But, yeah, any other thoughts on that point that Scott raised about human nature? I think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it reminds me of the self-driving cars that need to be programmed. and you know, there are times when a self-driving car will need to get into a crash that kills the driver in order to save, you know, a crowd of pedestrians on the sidewalk, say. And so to a T, everyone says, oh, yeah, you know, of course a self-driving car should do that. And then you ask them, well, would you buy that self-driving car if you were the driver? They go, like, no. I wouldn't want it to kill me. So there is something about that that I think is a really fascinating point of human nature.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing we've talked about is kind of the sort of cultural thing too. And I think it was Bob who said earlier, you know, it's not like all these kids are making the NFL. You know, yes, there's a monetary, you know, lift yourself out, be a super famous, awesome athlete type reason, you know, to get your kids playing football. But what's really interesting to me, you know, so I coached Little League Baseball for many years. Right. I mean, you deal with parents and, you know, these kids are not making the major leagues. Right. Maybe there's one kid that I coached over, you know, 5-6 years of coaching that, you know, he'll probably play college ball. But, you know, it's not. And I remember you see this in baseball. You see it in football with sort of risk taking. You see it with overuse of arms in baseball. You know, 10-year-olds who are the ace pitchers who just get sort of wrapped into it, and they're pitching in a tournament, and their team's there, and they're the ace, and they throw too many innings, and then 2 years later they're throwing their arm out. And I think it's the same thing in football. It's not a rational thing that's tied necessarily to, you know, linking to money or fame. Part of it is just kind of getting wrapped up in, you know, the sport and getting wrapped up in the cultural piece of it and the social piece of it. And I think that's another kind of human nature reason why it makes it so hard to push back against.
Well, you know, and it's interesting, Mike, because your point about the pitchers who throw out their arms and then, you know, or overuse their arms and 2 years later throw it out. A lot of the reason for the opioid epidemic now heroin epidemic is actually because it starts with athletes who injure themselves in sports, and so partly they get hooked on painkillers because they really are in pain, but partly they go into depression because so much of their self-identity as a man is wrapped up in sports, and now they're injured and they can't play sports anymore. And so the prescription drug use just escalates into other types of drugs. And so, like, when you start to think of how multi-layered this problem is, it's huge. It's huge.
Yeah, we've written about painkillers in the NFL, and there are a lot of folks in the NFL who are pushing for marijuana legalization because it's kind of the only thing that helps deal with the sort of pain, I understand. But that's a really good point. And, you know, the amazing thing about, like, the baseball-football analogy, and I wrote a piece on this once, it was after I read a book by this Yahoo Sports investigative journalist named Jeff Passan. It's called The Arm, and it was all about baseball. But having looked at this football issue, it's so similar and frustrating in that even as science has advanced, we haven't. Because, you know, in baseball, like, our arms are just not built to repeatedly throw, you know, 90-something mile an hour fastballs. There's just too much stress on our arm, especially with, you know, kids. So when you say, okay, well, what can we do about it? How can we reduce the risk? You know, the answer is, well, you just throw less. You throw less innings. You wait till you're older to throw, and then you don't throw as much. That's the only, you know, proven way to reduce these injuries. And it's the same thing in football. And, you know, that's unsatisfying if you're a real big baseball fan and your kid's great or you're great. You don't want to be, you know, the answer you're looking for is not, okay, well, just don't play or play less. But it's really the same answer in football. You know, people talk about, you know, what's the change that's going to make a difference here? How can we better protect ourselves? What rules can we change? What things can we do? And the only thing that will work is, you know, less tackling, less hitting, less hits. It means playing less. It means not playing, you know, well below 14, and that's really the only thing that fixes it. And that's, I understand it to be, you know, it's not the answer that people want to hear.
So this is Bob.
Go ahead, Bob.
Go ahead. So I'm thinking, as I do, about the emotional suppression that leads to the desperation of doing what is physically destructive. And there's something in this, you're a bright group here, there's something in this about how do you tie in the cultural mores or this legacy of, you know, don't show pain, don't admit fear, because that's what drives the popularity of this, is there's a ritualized way to prove you're a man. It's like circumcision, maybe, in a way, but how do we bring awareness to the dysfunction, the emotional dysfunction, which is underpinning this? To me, I think we're talking about a symptom of something much deeper, and we deal with the symptom because it in itself is destructive, but I think there's a bigger picture in it, too.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point and really well expressed. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Carol.
It's all right. Well, Thaddeus said, you know, we're bowing to this God that says, kill yourself. You know, and what normal person would do that? But this society, which has become capitalized to such an extent that we now believe that that's okay to die for money. So it is very deep, Bob. It's much deeper than I think that. I don't know how to counter it because it's all over the systems that we live under.
So I'm going to Carol, I respect what you're saying, and I'm also going to say that I think the father relationship is much more powerful than the corporate capitalistic thing. That the emotional connection with the kid, the approval of dad that I'm a good boy, is really the driving force. And educating fathers, what I want to say is, what would you do to keep your son from dying? Would you tell him about how you really feel? Would you tell him that you're afraid at times? Go ahead.
Well, I my son wanted to get a motorcycle, and I was very much opposed to it. And I told him that. Eventually, I told him he could get one because I was going to make a lot of money off of it. And he said, how? I said I was going to write a Reader's Digest article on how my son died.
Oh, gosh.
And he just looked at me because it never occurred to him, you know, how serious it was. And do you know, not 2 weeks later, his friend hit a tree and died on a bike.
Oh, my God.
So, I don't know how you get through. I don't know how you get through, but you're right. If dads and moms would not put the emphasis on football being the thing that shapes their son or daughter, any of the head sports, the thing that shapes their kid for the future, and understood you could learn a lot by playing chess, yeah, that would be good.
So this is Mike. I mean, thank you for that discussion. And I think that Bob sort of put his finger and took us back a little bit to, you know, what we're really talking about here, and what this group is all about. And we've been focusing on football and CTE as this really great example that's in the news, and we know people who are trying to change it, and it's this, you know, this thing we can touch and understand. But it's a symptom and a subset of the topic that we're here discussing at the Good Men Project, which is the disposability of men, which is a much broader issue than playing football. It is behaviors, and I agree that it's mainly, I mean, sure, there's moneyed interest here and corporate interest and popularity, but there's this thread that runs through it all of masculinity, where we're engaged in behaviors because they are accepted to be tough and cool and, you know, show, you know, manliness, and we're literally killing ourselves. And it's not just in football, that's just our example here. And I think, you know, Bob said it better than I did. And, you know, Carol, I think we're all struggling with how to change that, but it, you know, it cuts across so many areas.
Mark Green, did you see Mark Green's new video?
Yes,
so
Mark Green.
I think that addresses.
Yes. Yeah, Mark Green has a great video out. He's a writer with the Good Men Project for many years, writing about emotional intelligence and masculinity and toxic masculinity. And the example I was going to give is, you know, in the mental health group, right? And it's the same thing where for men, you know, being depressed is harder because the cultural piece of it says, don't reach out for help. Just tough it out. Suck it up. You know, if you're weak, it means you're weak. You know, if you're hurting, it means you're weak. And part of what we tried to do there is recast, you know, change that culture. And it's super hard, but that's why we're having these conversations. And that's why, you know, in the mental health group, we tried to change that by saying, you know, you know, you're not weak, you're just human. And having real men talking about that, I think just like here, you know, we could use, you know, is this really worth dying for? And what else is worth living for? And telling these stories. And I think that's, you know, in broad strokes, how we change that culture. But, yeah, it's a big, multifaceted, complicated thing.
What would be some other memes we could put up?
And I'd have to think about that. Maybe we can brainstorm in the intervening week. I do like the idea of launching off kind of what's currently in the news, the you know, not worth dying for. I think that we could make some hay with that for sure.
So let's start by doing a call for submissions. You know, about the news of the week and getting people to write on everything from, you know, is football worth dying for, to I really like Bob's thought about what would you do to keep your son from dying, whether this is child abuse. Let's just see if we can get some articles written. And then I do think we should come up with a series of just like 10 memes and just get on Twitter all at once and just, you know, put them all on Twitter during sort of one big push. I think that would be really good.
Yeah, I think that'd be great. All right, I've made a note of this.
And I'm happy to create the memes. That maybe we could just brainstorm on a post in the Facebook group, and we could all put ideas in there, and then I'm happy to create them.
That sounds great. Okay, I put that down as an action item to follow up on. And I've been hoping to just write about this sort of in general. I just haven't had the time yet, but I'll try and get something out in the intervening week as well. So there was one more issue that sort of came across my desk this week that I wanted to share with you guys that I thought was interesting and sad and difficult. You know, the way I got into this issue and first started writing about it for Good Men Project Sports like 3 years ago, was I read an interview with the lawyer who was the plaintiff's lawyer for the first class action lawsuit against the NFL relating to CTE and concussions. And it was he was featured in the New York Times Sunday magazine, and a friend knew him and introduced me, and I interviewed him too, and we put it up in the Good Men Project. His name is Jason Lukasiewicz. And so I've been sort of tracking that lawsuit, and the lawsuit's been very controversial. You know, ultimately, the NFL settled the lawsuit. They created a pool of money to give to players. There was a lot of criticism of the settlement. I forget the exact dollar amount, but it was in the hundreds of millions of dollars. But given the extent of injury and all the former players that it was supposed to cover, a lot of people criticize it for being, you know, not enough money. And, you know, I didn't really think too much about it. But this week, you know, a friend of mine who knows that I'm involved in this issue because of these calls and you know, I put out information on my Facebook page about it. And she knows that I've been involved in sort of local activism about youth football and CTE. She reached out and introduced me to the widow of a former player with the New York Giants, who was an offensive tackle and a Pro Bowl offensive tackle for many, many years. And he's thinking about submitting, or she, on his behalf, he passed away at the age of 70 back in 2004, and he had all sorts of, you know, issues that indicate that, you know, he may have had CTE, you know, mental health problems and dementia and all sorts of stuff. But he died in 2004 at the age of 71, you know, right, so 13 years ago. And she's putting together a claim to the NFL to get, you know, a monetary award from that NFL concussion settlement. And what's interesting and difficult and a problem I never really thought about is all these players, you know, that passed away before, and you know, any of this came into vogue. You know, he's never had, you know, he's dead and buried. His brain was never studied. His doctors are dead or gone or unconnected. Back then, there was never you know, a diagnosis of any particular, you know, issue that they can connect to CTE. So she's struggling to put together, you know, information, you know, about him that will entitle them to any money. And I think it's a position that a lot of these former players are in, and an issue that I never really thought about it. I'm not really quite sure what to do about it. You know, she contacted me because I'm a lawyer and because I'm involved in this stuff, saying, you know, do you have advice for them? And, you know, I'll look at it and think about it. But I wanted to share it with this group because it's just amazing, because even when you put together a pot of money that's supposed to solve this, you know, you don't really solve it for people who have suffered over time. So I just I thought that was interesting and kind of troubling. And if anyone has any bright ideas on an approach, let me know.
Yeah, I would say that that she should definitely try to go after it because, again, that's just the way that these stories keep coming out. And you know, it, she needs to be part of this group and this movement of people who are doing something about it. But
yep.
I think probably the best advice would be to just have her. You know, and maybe this is something that would be helpful. I think we've talked about this before. So if there was a simple list of things you should look out for, like signs that someone might have CTE, and then if she just had that list and could give specific examples of each of those signs,
That's a good little project. I like that. Good. So we have just a few minutes left, and then we can wrap up. But usually we take these few minutes for sort of closing thoughts from anyone that has them and sort of action items. And for me, the action items are to put together the call for submissions that Lisa talked about, and also to start thinking about memes that we can put out that are use the "Is football worth dying for?" as a jumping off point. And if I have an abundance of time, I'm just going to try to put an article out kind of about what I talked about in the beginning of this ConvoCast, which was just what's happened and the reaction on both sides and how we move forward. Those are my goals for the week on this. Any final thoughts or projects for anyone else as we go around?
No, I'm good.
Okay. And I should say, Bob, I loved your article on meditation. I thought it was a really great piece and appreciate you writing it.
Thanks.
It was live in the Goodman Project last week.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you all are doing this, and I feel kind of apolitical historically, and I'm just looking and listening. I see a lot of relationships, and appreciate the technology that you all have in the media, how you understand it. And but all I know is that in what I do, I haven't met a father yet who didn't want to be a good father.
Yeah.
And I've had very few fathers. A couple of them got steamed and left my office, but that's okay. But very few who wouldn't want to be emotionally closer with their kids. And that is in some way the price for telling your son that, no, you do not have to do that. You don't have to go play that. You know, I love you anyway, whatever the category is.
Yeah, being a good father is a really good hook, and I'd love to think about how to use that. And, you know, as for technology and memes and Facebook, to me, it's got to get these stories out here. And if we can produce the stories that are compelling, you know, we can figure out how to get them out for sure. But, you know, the idea about fathers, it's an interesting point because, you know, I'm not seeing a lot of fathers speaking out. You know, all these CTE activists, it's the mothers on the front line. It's Debbie Pica and Kimberly Archie and Cindy Faisal and Karen Kendall. They've been on this call, but it creates for me this kind of, it's a bad dynamic. It's a bad look for us, you know, as men. And I think it makes them susceptible to, you know, this argument, you know, oh, well, those are just moms and they're all kind of, you know, they're just, woo, they're just taking this way too seriously, and, you know, they just don't get football. It's just these kind of frantic moms, right? So it sets up for this issue, but and part of what I tried to do when I went down there for the CTE Awareness Day was say, no, it's not just moms, it's families.
right? These people have these young boys that passed away, these men that are dying, they have brothers and their fathers, and there were fathers there. But it's interesting to me that, you know, at least in the activist community, it seems like the women who are on the front line. But I love that hook of trying to get into, you know, being a good father and tying this to that. I think that's a really interesting idea.
So, Michael, you've talked about a whole bunch of NFL big names. What about them as a pool of, I mean, I'm just having this image of you give me 11 players, you know, and put them up there and have it look like a really, you know, tough group of offense or defense, whatever it is, and then have it break into something that each of these guys decided some way, you know, to be on this side of the football question. Does that make any sense, what I'm saying?
Yeah, to use them as positive role models, right? Like men and big football guys who eventually said, yeah, I'm not going to die for that.
Yeah. And I just, recruiting male voices is difficult, and at the same time, I think the encouragement is very important because you are the culture that is going to change this. And if you're not inviting and encouraging in a broader sense, which is the question I hear you asking, how do we broaden this and encourage it?
Yes.
So.
Yeah, so, you know, by having this group at the Goodman Project, we're trying to encourage more people in the conversation. We do have some connections to sort of, you know, famous-y people like, you know, Junior Seau is a Pro Bowl, super famous football player. I met his sister, Mary Seau, who's now an activist for this. But yeah, I mean, it's relationships in terms of getting, you know, actual NFL players or recently retired NFL players, but there is an increasing pool of those people. It'd be really interesting to try and get them involved in some way, or even if they're not personally involved, to write something or put a meme with all those faces together, because those are pretty manly men, you know, making a call to protect themselves and their families and their bodies and their brains. But yeah, I think it's a good homework item to think about ways that we can get more men in this conversation and more influencers into the conversation.
And using the existing platform just doggedly, just staying with it, making it a regular part of it, like the cigarette campaign didn't go away. It's still here. And
right.
Keeping that.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Any final thoughts, Lisa? Anyone else?
No, I thought this call was great, and it always gets me fired up to actually go out and take some action and keep the conversation going. And I do feel as if there's some momentum now, some real serious momentum behind this. So I think it's more important than ever to leverage that momentum and really create the change we want to see.
Agreed. Well, thank you all for joining tonight. We'll end here and we'll pick it up next week, and I look forward to talking to you all then. Thanks again.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.